Okay. I'm already running late on this. Let's try to. So I want to get into a bit of history of HCI. Before, there was this one last slide on what I call interaction paradigms. Now, I said that we have this computer, human, and interaction taking place, and I said that the computer and human are different, have different capabilities, and therefore it's interesting when the human can use the computer to do things that wouldn't be able to do otherwise, and that the computer can also harness the power of humans. Now, what you'll find in the literature is that there's three large categories of ways of thinking about user interaction or interactive systems. One is the one that I'll really focus on is the computer as a tool. Sometimes it's called first-person interface because the human is the actor that's using the computer as a tool, as you know, you use a pen to write or a screwdriver to screw something. And here the perspective is one of augmentation. We want to augment the capabilities of the user. Now, there's another approach that you also read about a lot that I call computer as partner or second person interface, because here the goal or the principle is to delegate tasks, to have the computer do something for me with, in a sense, minimal interaction. In computer as tool, I have to do all the work through the computer, with the computer. In computer as partner, I delegate tasks. So, you see this in systems based on so-called intelligent agents, where you know you can say, well, find me a flight to New York for my next trip, and the system will figure it out to go see in your calendar when is your next trip, and will book a flight and knows that you prefer to fly this company and this and that. So here I'm delegating tasks so I don't have to do it myself. A lot of artificial intelligence work is in the perspective. And then there's a third one, which I call the third-person interfaces, where the computer is really meant as a medium to communicate with other people. And that, of course, has exploded with social media, with you know Facebook and all these things, where the goal of the computer, let's not talk about the goal of Facebook, but the goal of the computer in this applications of social media is to create new ways for people to stay in touch, to communicate to each other, and to create online communities. Now, in actual systems, these things tend to be mixed together. So, for example, if you go onto a website like Amazon to buy something, a lot of it is a computer as a tool. I have a search engine, I have a catalog, I can navigate through things. But there's also an element of computer as partner because the system is going to suggest things to me, to recommend things based on my history of past interactions, based on what other people have done. And so it's trying to ease my work of looking for something by making suggestions. And I often take the example of going to a library or to a bookstore. Sometimes you know exactly what you want, and you know the library or the bookstore very well, so you can go directly to the right shelf, pick it up, and you're done. That would be a first-person interface. Now sometimes you know exactly what you want, but you don't know where it is, or you're in a hurry, or you're lazy, so you can go to the person at the bookstore and say, oh, can you get me the last book by X and Y? And the person will do it for you, so that's more delegation. And there's no one that's better than the other. Sometimes you want to do it one way, sometimes the other way. Now, there's also the situation where you don't know what you want. And here too, you can do the first person interface where you go in the bookstore and you look around. And you know there are areas you like, but there's also serendipity. On the way to going to the novel section, you run into a psychology section and suddenly you run into something you didn't expect. Or you can also ask the person at the desk for a recommendation. Oh, I'm looking for something to read this summer. And maybe the person knows you and can do a personalized recommendation, or the person doesn't know you and will probably do a less good job. So again, we have this notion of, you know, doing the thing by yourself, which has some advantages and some drawbacks. It can be a long time. If you throw me into a bookstore, I will probably not get out until it closes. Or asking for help, delegating the task, which also has some advantages and some drawbacks. I think it actually the future of interactive computing is really doing a much better work at combining these two things together. Right now, it's seen as sort of a bit too separate, I think, and people who don't necessarily understand or want to understand each other. Now, the computer as media has become a big thing with not only social media like Facebook, but the notion that, you know, you go on to any news site and you have an endless stream of comments by people. And again, that is an aspect that is being weaved into a lot of the tools we use, most often for, I think, the wrong reasons. The wrong reasons being collecting personal information to make money out of it. But I think it's also an important aspect because human beings are social animals. And every time you add a social element, usually it gets a lot of traction. So in this course, we're focusing a lot on the computer as tool because that's the things we know and I know and doing my research. But I think you will hear about some of these, well, depending on which program you're in, but about these other things in other classes. So what I want to do now is to move into a little bit of a historical perspective on HCI. And so I call this a short history of human-computer interaction. Of course, there's no way I can do something anywhere near complete about this, but I want to give you, I think, about five, maybe six milestones, I think, in the history of HCI. So something that is often cited more in the hypertext community, maybe than HCI, but as one of the great founding visions of interactive systems is MEMX by Vannevar Bush. So Vannevar Bush, so that's back in 1945. And what were computers like in 1945?
Big.
Yeah. They were big. They were like, yeah, this room size. And they were doing things that your watch is much faster than doing today. And in fact, 45, there were not even many of them, literally. So he had this vision. So he was, I think, was the founder of DARPA, but he was working for the government, and he had this vision of a desktop, literally this desktop information management system. Now he didn't think it could be done with computers because computers at the time were used for, as I say, you know, military applications and things like this. But he had this notion that with an electromechanical system, there would be documents stored in there, and you'd have a bunch of buttons, and you'd be able to recall the document through some kind of query, and then you'd be able to link documents together and go from one document to another through a kind of ancestor of a hypertext system. Now, the thing that's important in Bush's work is to read the paper and to see the vision that he had. He had no idea, or he had an idea but that was not practical on how to realize it. But he did understand that the fact that we're dealing more and more with information and a lot of the tasks we do are are linked to the ability to manipulate complex information, you would need to have systems to support that.
There would be a lot more to say about Bush, but I want to spend time on
a few other things that I think are more directly relevant. So we jump almost 20 years and we get to Sketchpad. Now Sketchpad was Evan Sutherland's PhD dissertation. And he did that at the Lincoln Lab in the Massachusetts Institute of Technology at MIT. And he used what is arguably the first personal computer, in that it was a computer about, again, the size of this room, even 20 years later. And in a corner, there was this device, which was this display, a bunch of buttons, and a pen, an optical pen. So you could actually tap on the screen and provide input to the system in terms of coordinates. And so in 1963, he created a system called Sketchpad, which was a system to create drawings on the screen to specify geometrical shapes, but also geometrical constraints, where you can zoom in and out the way you do today on Google Maps. Invented all the basic interactions that you have today on desktop computers, like clicking and dragging and creating shapes. So I have a little clip here that will show you the system. The videos will be online, so I'm going to go fairly quickly just to okay. So here he's using his left hand to select commands. Here, using a different command, he's selecting all these segments and is telling them be orthogonal to each other. Then the system runs a simulation to approximate these constraints and turns this into a square shape without doing anything. Now, if you know any system that does that today, let me know, because maybe CAD systems like AutoCAD do this, but you can't do that in PowerPoint or Illustrator. Here, he's doing it again. I want these two things to be parallel. And then he's going to create here, turn this line into a set of dashes. Well, that arguably could be done more efficiently. He didn't. Well, it means you have gesture recognition, because he's doing this fast gesture because it's recognized as such. I love the bimodal interaction. He's using his pen with the right hand and the left hand for commands. Here you saw him zoom out very smoothly, especially given what they had at the time. And here he's going to create another object, which is a bolt. So he's doing these two diagonals because he's going to use them in the constraint system. Here he's doing a circle. You see a circle that goes perfectly from one end to the next of the segment. Again, he's doing the square angle thing, so the system reshapes it. And then he's going to change again the shape, so you see dragging in real time. So give it a different aspect ratio, resolve the constraint, etc. I'm going to stop here, but you should watch the end of the segment, because then he's going to use that bolt and creates an instance of it and put it onto the other piece we saw first. So you have this notion of having creating a prototype object, then multiple instances of it, putting them in various places, and then if you change the prototype, all the instances change. That was 1963. It's really, I mean, if you think of it, we haven't invented much in terms of graphical interaction since then. And again, some things like the constraints are not even in today's systems or most of the systems that are used today. So even Sutherland actually didn't stop there. He created, and I'll show a picture later on, the first virtual reality system a few years after that. He also founded the company Evans and Sutherland, which for many, many years was with Silicon Graphics, the company doing the best computer graphics systems in the world.
Now, at the time at the LinkedIn Lab, a bunch of other things were happening, and in fact, Ron Becker came after Sutherland and did the first interactive animation system on the computer.
So he was able to do something where you draw a circle simulating a ball, and then you draw a trajectory like the ball bouncing, and then you tell the system, well, animate the ball on this trajectory.
And that was done again 55, almost 60 years ago. So the next thing I want to talk about is Engelbart. And Engelbart is an amazing character, and is probably the person we owe the most in HCI. So he's most well known for the things that's probably the less important to him. He's the inventor of the mouse. Now, did you know that the mouse was invented in 1963? Where were you in 1963? He also, I wouldn't say invented, but because we saw it at Evan Sutherland, but in the system he created, there was this notion of bimanual interaction, the notion that you had a hand to control the cursor and another hand, in that case, on what he calls a QWERTY keyboard to enter commands, which is a lot more efficient than the sort of interaction we have where you have to do sort of keyboard shortcuts on the keyboard. But he didn't invent that for the sake of inventing that. He invented that because he had gone to the war and came back to the war saying, you know, why are people spending so much their energy killing each other? There are more important problems to solve in the world. But if you want to solve a problem that may lead to a situation where people are less, I guess, angry at each other, a single person cannot do it. We're starting to have computers, we're in the 1960s, we're starting to have computers, and there's great promise of computers, but computers alone are not going to solve it. So we need to create a system that will combine the brain power of many users with the electronic brains of many computers, so that together we can address complex problems. And so it created a system that was the first hypertext system. That was the first system to support cooperative work, where multiple users at a distance were doing what you do in Google Docs today. Now, Google Docs is about 5 years old, right? It's taken almost 30 years before, more than 40 years, between something that was demonstrated by Engelbart in the 60s and something mainstream like Google Doc. Not only did they support document sharing, but also video conferencing. I'm going to show you here a segment of another video. So what he did is that in 1968, he organized an event, or at an event, he organized a demo that lasted close to 2 hours in front of, several hundred people, demonstrating his system, which was called NLS, Online System, and then was called Augment. So here is Doug Engelbart. I'm not going to do the audio. So here's the system. And so that's the hypertext that you can... maybe I should have some audio.
I'd like to have him see my text. So in his display, he sees my text. This is what I'll execute. Sure enough, it does.
And
what's that? Running around?
Well,
he's looking at my text. He'd like to have something to say about it. So we put on a marker, a tracking spot that he controls. So he's sitting there in the middle park looking at this text, and he can point to it. But we carefully reserved for me the right to control or operate on this. So my bug is more powerful than yours. But we can have an argument. Yeah. That's like a good fight. Now, computer, do the automatic switching that will bring in a camera picture with the camera mounted on his console, such as the camera mounted on mine. I know. That's great. Now we're connected. Audio, you can see my work, you can point at it, I can see your face, we can talk. So let's do some collaborating.
So, I mean, this is called the mother of all demos, because it was an absolutely stunning event. Now, I realize that for you guys, you know, you've grown up with computers. You use Skype or whatever. You use Google Docs. You're familiar with all that. So I think it's a bit hard to realize how important this kind of work was. But without people like this, you would not have Skype today. And the fact it has taken so much time to get from this vision and working system to mainstream systems like Skype and others today is mind-boggling. In fact, you know, I've been teaching this stuff for a number of years. I think it was a lot easier, like maybe 5-6 years ago, before there was Google Doc, before Skype was really video conferencing was mainstream, because I could show things that people were not using every day. Now you use this stuff every day, but it was not invented by Microsoft or Apple or whoever. It came from this research. And this research came from a vision of creating this socio-technical systems that combine the power of humans with the power of computers. So, next step.
The spreadsheet. 1979. Dan Ricklin was a Harvard graduate. And at Harvard, you learn about being you're doing an MBA, and you spend a lot of time doing budgets and summing out columns of numbers. And he said, well, why not do a program? And at the time he did that in the Apple II, that would do this for me. And his first spreadsheet was really just that. It was the idea that you could do simple operations by writing formulas in this grid thing. And the system would compute their formulas and recompute them every time you change something that affected the formula. But at the time, the goal was just to have the computer do the boring part and the easily computerizable part of what they were doing with the pen, pencil and paper. Now, the thing that is amazing with the spreadsheet is that people started using it for doing things completely different. Well, first of all, they could do what-if budgets. Instead of doing one budget where you have, imagine a big company doing their budget by hand. They have to add up all these lines. They need to know, you know, their income. They have to add the numbers from sales and this and that and expenses and personnel, and they do this by hand. So once they've managed to do one budget that sort of holds, they stop there. But with this thing, you could say, oh, what if I hire 20 more people? What if we do this? What if we do that? So it completely changed the way people were doing budgeting. But then people started using this for completely different things, for running simulations. It's even been used for using the semi-graphics at the time part to create VLSI designs in there. Or doing, I think there have been even seen things with animation, taking advantage of how slow the computation happens to create animations. So I think that is an amazing example of how a simple idea, simple in appearance, gives people a completely new way to reinvent things and to use it in ways that were not anticipated at all. And there are very few examples like the spreadsheet, really. And I think that's sad, because I'm sure we could have many more spreadsheets for the minds than we have today. Now the next step is personal computer. Personal computer in the sense of a machine that could be used for, you know, the Apple II was a personal computer, but it was more like a hobby. It's not much used in industry. Now Xerox PARC is the research center created by Xerox. Xerox is the company that invented xerography, so it had patents on photocopying for years and years. But they knew the patents would run out, and they would need to get into other businesses if they wanted to survive. So they funded a research center called PARC, Palo Alto Research Center, that invented an amazing number of technologies we use every day. They invented the Ethernet. They invented the Xerox printer, the laser printer. But they also invented a bunch of things in networking, in databases, in programming languages. For 30 years, Xerox PARC was really the main epicenter of interesting stuff in computer science. And from the 70s, they started a program to research graphical workstations. So there was the Alto and the Dolphin and the Dorado. And finally, in 1981, they created a product called the Xerox. Well, it's known as the Xerox Star, which was an internal code name, and it was the first commercial graphical workstation. It had a large black and white display. It had a keyboard with command keys on the sides. It had a mouse with two buttons. And it was designed for executive secretaries, for people who deal with documents, who have to send the memos around the company, who have to create the reports. And so the interface was created really in response of this user population. And secretaries, guess what? They deal with documents and files and mail trains. And the reason we have windows and icons with files and things like this today on our computers is because of this. Now, when you look at this, it's remarkably similar to what you have on any computer today. There are windows, there are menus. In fact, there are very few menus. They didn't like menus so much. There are dialog boxes. There are documents that mix drawings and text and graphs and tables. You can do freehand drawing. Here you have access to printers. You have a calculator, you have a clock, you have a mail inbox. In a sense, you could ask, since 1981, so it's been how many years? 25? What have we done? What have we done? You can also ask yourself, is it really meaningful for people who are not executive secretaries to have to deal with icons and files and folders and things like this? Well, I don't know that it makes sense for everyone. But we haven't found a good replacement. Now, the other thing that you will find is that this is much more than what you think. You have no notion of application. You open a document, you want to put text in it, you put text in it. You want to put graphics, you put graphics. You want a table, you put a table. You don't have to juggle between Excel, PowerPoint, Word, God knows what, Illustrator. Everything is editable in place. Even more than that, this table I created in my document, I put numbers, and this graph, I said, well, graph this table. If I change the number in the table, the graph updates. Do you know any system today where you can do that? Numbers? Pages? You can have a table and a graph in pages without going, I don't know, I haven't tried the last one. But if it were, it would be very new, it would be the very first. So I don't think I have time to show the video of the Xerox Star demo, but I really encourage you to look through it. The first part is talking about the hardware, probably not interesting to you, but you have to understand they created everything. They created the hardware, not the processor, but the processor slices that they put together. They created the programming language, they created the operating system, they created the screen, they created the keyboard. And that's because they could create everything, that they could control everything, and create a real breakthrough. Now, commercially, it was a disaster because it was too expensive. And the one thing they missed is that there could be a software industry developing software for things like this. They thought, you know, they would do the software, you buy the machine, it comes with the software, and then maybe we give you an update here and there. But it was not open for others to build software.
And that's a big difference with the Macintosh.
Now, the Macintosh was designed from the ground up to be a cheaper machine because it was the next Apple machine after the Apple II, so it was targeting the masses. But the thing that really, I think, made a difference is it came up with three applications, the Finder, MacPaint, MacWrite, and that set the standard for what an application should be on the Macintosh. And then they opened it up, they made available what we call an SDK today, a development kit, so people could easily build applications in that environment that will have the same qualities in terms of interaction as those three basic applications. And then, of course, you know, Microsoft caught up and really copied that. Of course, there was a lot of influence from the Xerox Star into the Macintosh, but there was a lot of influence from Engelbart's work into the Xerox Star. And all of this is sort of a continuous process. It's very hard to trace each thing. I think what is important, and what most people don't acknowledge here, is that they kept the notion of application that they had on the Apple II and that they had on previous personal computers. So you had to launch MacPaint, and then Finder was not available until you quit MacPaint because the thing could run one thing at a time. You could go into MacPaint, do a drawing, copy it, quit MacPaint, launch MacWrite, to paste it into MacWrite, but you couldn't edit it in place. And I don't know to this day whether this was due to the computer would not be powerful enough to do it, but the Mac was pretty much the same power as the Xerox Star. I think they just didn't catch this notion from the Star that applications are just meaningless to normal people. They were probably sort of too influenced by what had been done before on personal computers. My last stop in this quick historical perspective is the World Wide Web. Now, the World Wide Web, as we know it, was not created in 1994. It starts back in the 80s. But it started catching up in around 93, 94 when CERN decided to open it up to the world. Now, the thing I want to say about the World Wide Web is the first web browser was also a web page editor. So this is actually a picture of it on the next workstation where I have several pages from CERN. And somewhere there's something selected here, Atlas. And here I can say link, and link to mark. So somewhere else I've marked a destination page, and I'm creating this as a link to that page. So the original web browser was designed to be an authoring tool. Then Next didn't succeed commercially, so someone implemented a new browser on a different platform. That new browser was Mosaic by Mark Anderson, and he didn't have time to implement the editor. And so since then, we've been stuck with browsers that only do browsing. And only in recent years, we've seen the completely insane idea that you would ship the editor with your web page. I mean, any web page where you can actually enter text or edit a post or something, the code for doing this is in the page. It's not in the browser on your client, it's shipped with the page. So everybody has a different editor, everybody has a different calendar to when you select dates and if you want to book a flight or a hotel or something. It's completely insane. It makes absolutely no sense. And that's because someone was lazy when they re-implemented the original browser. I don't think they were just lazy, they just misunderstood what this was all about. Because from Berners-Lee perspective, the web was there to make everybody not only a reader, but an author, a publisher. But then the idea was taken as just distributing information, and only a few people would do the editing.
So to summarize this, because I'm running late and Emmanuel has arrived and he needs to take a bit more of your time before you get to the break, I think
What I want to point out and why I selected these particular items in the history is because at the same time as computers have been doing more and more, we've been doing correspondingly less and less with them, I believe. With endless augment from Engelbart, he has this great, grand idea of augmenting human intellect to support cooperative work at various scales. And cooperative work is not just about sharing documents or having access to shared stuff in the cloud or sending each other endless copies of things. It was real sharing. I think the way we use sharing today is completely wrong. Sharing means sending out copies. To me, that's not sharing. Sharing is sharing. It's the same object. But it was not about just sharing objects. It was also about human communication, supporting verbal and visual communication through video and audio integrated in the very documents that you were sharing. Then with the Xerox Star, we went to personal use, but network transparency. The Star would give you access to networked resources like printers and servers. You configure it once and then you forget about it. To this day, trying to access a remote server on your computer is a mess. And you have silly things like Dropbox and all these services that shouldn't really be designed the way they are. Then you get to the Macintosh where you get personal use, but network access, as I said, becomes sort of explicit. You have to struggle to integrate the networking stuff in your system. And we move from document-centric, which I think makes sense in terms of mental models of things we do in the real world, to application-centric, which I think makes no sense from a human perspective. And then we get to the World Wide Web, where, yes, we have transparency of the network, but we have extremely poor user interaction. And to this day, we're still trying to do in the web page the stuff we've been doing for 30 years in the desktop, and we do it poorly, frankly. So that's my story about innovation in HCI. And one thing, I'm going to skip that. One thing that I like is this description by Bill Buxton of what's called the long nose of innovation. Now, I don't know if you know about the long tail, the notion of long tail, where you sell books, you have a few books that sell a lot, and then many books that sell very little. But contrary to popular belief, you can make a lot of money out of the long tail if you manage it well. So he's talking about the long nose, which is the different process, which is going from invention, where the revenue over time is going to grow exponentially. You invent something, you invent the mouse. Well, Engelbart didn't make a single cent out of the mouse. He patented it, but it was a mouse with two wheels, and then this was not working very well. So all the mice that were commercialized were using a different sort of principle with a ball instead of two wheels, so he didn't get any money out of this patent. And then he gets, into commercial products like the Xerox Star. Didn't sell well. The Macintosh sold well for a tiny company like Apple at the time, but no big deal. And then suddenly, it's on every Microsoft machine. And by 1995, for a device invented in 1963, you get wide adoption. And I defy you to give me a technology in computer or elsewhere, but in computer and in interaction, where something that is widely adopted today does not have a 30-year experience history behind it from invention to mass adoption. Now think about it, and next week I will probe you if you have ideas, and we can go around a few things that have been massively adopted and see how we can trace them.
In the first web browser editor, anyone could edit a page? Or?
Well, you need to have access right on the server to do the post query, but that was just a simple logging process, so you could post it. Yeah, there was the notion of access right. It's not true that everybody could post create pages anywhere. You need to have the access right. but the editor was a feature of the browser. Any more questions? Yes? So, did this get you thinking, or are you bored already? Well, I will see you next week. And before you go, Emmanuel, come, and he's going to tell you, well, actually, this is for the M1 students, right?
Yes.
So, do we let the others, do we set them loose?
Yes, maybe, so.
Yeah, okay. So this is for the, so Emmanuel Valère is in charge of the innovation and entrepreneurship section of the HCID program. So if you are in the M2 research program, you actually can leave.
Thank you.